I apologize.
Yeah. Okay, call to order the House Education Committee for March 2nd, 2015. Okay, welcome everybody. What we're going to be doing is we've got a public hearing on three bills. We're going to have a work session on one or two others. So if you're ready to speak on a bill, don't forget to sign up. So with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on, and these were all, these are kind of continuations. These were the bills that we heard last week, but we had a little accident in the hearing room and had to continue the hearings. So we've already heard part of this. And if you, on these bills, if you spoke last time, you don't need to speak again because we've got all of that on record. It's just for additional information. So with that, I'm opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2579. Richard, if you could...
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2597 directs the school district director for special education to evaluate a child to determine if the child has a disability and if truancy or unexcused absence is a manifestation of the disability. If requested by the parent or the child has not been evaluated within the previous 12 months, it prohibits the scheduling of attendance conference until the evaluation is conducted, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2015.
Okay, thank you.
She's not here. She's supposed to be
there. And so who we have signed up is Shane Jackson, Toby Rates, and then we'll have Morgan and Chuck talk on the other panel. Mm-hmm.
For the record, Shane Jackson, lobbyist, Autism Society of Oregon. Thank you very much for this opportunity. Ms. Rates is not here yet. She's executive director of the Autism Society of Oregon. But from hearing from your preamble, I think we'll just keep this real quick. We've had some very good constructive dialogue since our last hearing and have come to the conclusion that some certain terms need to be refined to mm-hmm. everybody's satisfaction, and a small little Scribner's error needs to be removed. To satisfy, I think we can satisfy everybody in the process. Very small scope of language that we need to talk about. Really having trouble with the word cause, and I think we've got a dash on the process right now that could bring about a satisfactory conclusion. That's my hope.
Okay, then. Because I know that the parties have been working together. And I've seen some of the amendments, and they're not all brought forward yet. But I appreciate you guys getting together and coming up with something that you can all work with.
And I think if we have another hearing, even a possible work session, I think we could bring something that would hopefully come to everybody's satisfaction on this.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Mr. Jackson? Okay, thank you very much. We did have Toby Rates, Morgan Allen, and Chuck Bennett.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen from the Oregon School Boards Association. I'll be very brief. I had a chance to talk to Mr. Jackson in the hallway today and understand there may be some amendments coming, but I think our message from OSBA and COSA as well is you have a whole host of special education-related bills in this committee, and we're hearing a lot of feedback from our special education directors. And one of the worst things that we have to do every session is, and I've been doing this since 2007, is that something happens in the interim where the outcome for a child and a student was terrible. And so then we get legislation to correct that. And sometimes those bills are drafted too broadly or have a lot of fiscal impacts for many of our districts that are doing things the right way. So I think our request today is we know you have a lot of these bills, including this one. We'd hope that we have plenty of time during this session. I'm not talking about putting this off to the interim or outside the session, but we have time during this session to get some of our conscientious special ed directors in a room with some of these advocates and have some conversations and see if we can actually come up with something that is workable and meets the intent of what the sponsors are trying to do, but also is within the parameters of the resources our districts have to do those evaluations. So that's generally our comment.
Thank you.
My name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I would just second Mr. Allen's comments, we particularly want to make sure that we're able to get special ed folks into the room. We're often asked to come sit in on work groups, and we just don't bring the specialized knowledge to the table. We can talk about broad policy issues, we can talk about resources, but when you get into an area like special education with both its state and federal legal ramifications, as well as just having an understanding on the ground of the resources that are available and the kind of resources needed to meet some of the requests made in the bills, we just feel like those are really the best folks to get into the room if we can to work on these. And we have found, we hope most of you have found, that these work groups can often be the most successful way to find common ground and look for the best, look out for the best interest of students.
Okay. And so I appreciate that, because I know sometimes it's we in the legislature we deal with issues that affect everybody where maybe there's only a problem in a certain areas, so I appreciate you bringing that to us. Okay, any questions for these gentlemen? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, Toby Rates.
Ms. Rates is the Executive Director of Autism Society of Oregon. She hasn't made it here yet, so she
okay.
Go ahead and skip over her.
Okay, thank you. Okay, is there anybody else that would like to speak on this? We had Dr. Kimberly Sherman that might also be speaking.
Which bill are we speaking on?
Pardon?
Which bill?
This is on 2597, the special ed truancy.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else want to speak on this bill? Okay, with that, we close the public hearing on House Bill 2579 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2673.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2673 requires the school district to prepare an annual summary that describes special education and related services provided by school districts during the previous school year. It directs school districts to complete an evaluation or reevaluation of students for special education related services within 60 calendar days of receiving consent from parent for evaluation or reevaluation. It declares an emergency effective 1st of July 2015.
Okay. Do we have anyone signed up on this one? Okay, Dr. Kimberly, were you going to, or Dr. Sherman, were you going to speak on this one?
Can I have a notification? Or I can just run it simultaneously this way. I'll do it this way. That's okay. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dougherty, and here's the committee.
To use this to go through your slides, please.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Technology.
Yeah. So I'm going to try and do a dual thing here because I've got my notes visible, not on the screen though. So I'm Kim Sherman. I earned a PhD in special education from the University of Oregon in 2007. I have served in Oregon as a special education director for a small, medium-sized school district. I've taught both general education and special education courses at Western Oregon, as well as the University of Oregon. And recently, I was the assistant director for the administrative licensure program for the University of Oregon. And I'm here today in support of House Bill 2673, in particular the section related to the 60 school days versus 60 calendar days timeline for initial evaluations. There we go. So this is the text of the bill here that was just read to us, where the proposal is to move the state of Oregon to a 60 calendar day timeline from the time that a parent first turns in their consent for evaluation on an initial evaluation request for a child with potential special education service needs, and the time that the school district needs to complete that eligibility finding and have a meeting with the parent to share the findings of that evaluation. This is more of the language from the federal law, IDEA. So you've heard some testimony about the IDEA, and one particular person, and I wish I could remember the name, said that the IDEA already tells us 60 school days, and in fact it does not. The IDEA's limits are 60 days, and then the federal law leaves it to states to define what days means. So in Oregon, we define days to mean school days, whereas many states define days to be calendar days. This is our current evaluation timeline in OAR, initial 60 day from the written consent to the time that the evaluation should be completed. After the initial evaluation is completed, districts have an additional 30 days, calendar days, not school days, to implement an individual education plan for those students for whom evaluation showed a need for special education. When you look across the country and look at timelines in other states, not that Oregon needs to follow other states, certainly, but just to get a sense of what other states look at, two states define days as business days, 18 states define it as school days, and 31 states define days to be calendar days for the initial evaluations. States that define days to mean calendar days, this is the breakdown of how many calendar days those states give to their districts to complete their evaluation. Six of 18 allow 60 calendar days, school days, and then the rest have a much shorter time period when they define days to mean school days. This is way too small for you to see, but it just shows you which states offer which kind of timeline. And right around us, Washington State allows 35 school days for initial evaluations to be complete. California allows 60 calendar days. Nevada, 45 school days. Idaho, 60 calendar days. So just within the Pacific Northwest, what used to be our Pac-10 schools, The variability of timelines is pretty apparent. So 60 school days is quite a lot of time. In Oregon, our districts do work very, very hard to meet the current evaluation timelines of 60 school days. Very small percentage of students' evaluations fall outside of the 60 school day timeline. Very, very few kids. So the districts are doing a pretty good job of meeting the 60 school day timeline. This is reasons why those few kids didn't make it in under that timeline. You've heard testimony that it's difficult to get medical statements, that parents aren't presenting their children for evaluation, and other reasons for these delays, and this is the breakdown of the numbers in Oregon. There's quite a range of how long passed.
Excuse, if we go back to that other slide.
Of course.
So it looks like a lot of these are kind of delays outside the control of the teacher of the school district.
For instance, the parent guardian did not attend the eligibility meeting within 60 days. Is that what you're looking at, that first row? Right. So that's correct. You can't force a parent to attend, and you can't you can't begin to talk about an IEP until a parent has given consent for placement in special education services. So that's sort of a closed door that school districts don't have an opportunity to overcome. But the proposed language of the bill doesn't allows that to continue. In other words, you know, you can't force a parent to come to an eligibility meeting and sign forms that they're not going to come. And so that won't change now or with the new bill.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Representative Springer and Representative Frederick, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does your data list out some of the delays, the specific reasons for the delays on the district or program evaluation staff?
These data come from Oregon Department of Education, and they are data that school districts supply, and I don't know that we can get disaggregated reasons like that.
Okay, so we don't
really know.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Frederick?
So am I reading this correctly? Say for 2013, 207 cases were delayed because of delays by district program and evaluation staff.
Correct.
Versus 10 that were delayed by way of parent and guardian eligibility. So the concern should be what's happening in terms of the district and programming staff.
That's correct.
Okay.
And this is out of 17,000.
This is out of 17,000. So 207, 37, 42, 242 kids out of 17,000 something. That's correct.
Thank you. Representative Hack.
So if it's determined that it's a staff issue, is it, but we don't know what the staff reason
is. We don't. And in Oregon, there are shortages of key staff positions, school psychologists, speech language therapists, et cetera, and they will continue to exist whatever the timeline happens to be. They exist nationwide.
So the Special Education Child Fund is part of ODE?
Oregon Department of Education does collect data from each district related to, that's correct, Special Education Child Fund. And then the Oregon Department of Education takes those data and submits it to the federal government.
So is Special Education Child Fund part of, because that's what your source is. So.
Right. That's out of ODE. Right. So this is all of the districts in Oregon.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Oh, no. Thank you. Okay. So by and large, the greatest number of delays happen. The children are eventually evaluated and the eligibility meeting held within 70 school days, so only 10 days. Up to 10 days late, and then smaller and smaller numbers as you get further and further away from the 60 calendar day limit. By comparison, in Oregon, early intervention has a evaluation timeline of 45 calendar days. So for babies, birth to three, infants and toddlers, the evaluation teams for that group of kids has a much shorter timeline, 50 calendar instead of school days, and are doing a pretty bang-up job of getting those evaluations turned in. Now, granted, there are fewer overall kids, but those kids exist in every district. You've heard some testimony, and I think most districts would agree that there are four major obstacles to a change in the timelines or concerns that they might have. The first would be the medical statements. And if you give me 1 second, I need to catch up on my notes.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. Can I just ask a clarifying question while you're catching up?
Sure.
So is the criteria for the early childhood intervention, which you say they're doing in 45 days, different than the criteria that they have to do for the IEPs? And
correct. So there's two groups of children with different timelines. Early intervention, which is babies to three-year-olds, fall under a 45 calendar day timeline, and 3 to 5 and 5 to 21, so school age, preschool and school age, kids fall under the 60 school days calendar, or 60 school days timeline.
But is the criteria for the evaluation different for those, so that they're... So
no, they still have to... Parents, medical statements on many of the disability categories, observations in natural settings and things like
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Right. They're equally robust. So under medical statements, the current law and the proposed change in law would continue to have the ability for school districts to have both either a medical statement from a doctor or a health assessment statement, which is from a certified nurse practitioner. So some school districts probably use, if they are lucky enough to have a school nurse attached to their district, probably can use those school nurses for those medical statements or health assessment statements. And districts will tell you that they can't control a doctor's timeline and getting that document back in time. But it's something that we all face all the time, and you know, we do our best to overcome it. Changing the timeline to 60 calendar days, you'll have the same requirements, and you'll just need to tighten up the follow-up on the doctors.
Okay, because I have a question. So if you don't get anything from the physician for 90 days, what happens?
I believe that you can request I'd have to reread the bill to tell you for sure, but I think that you can, with mutual agreement, extend that timeline with the parent.
Because there just seem to be some things outside of the district's control.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. If the parents and students are unavailable, there are current... There are current procedures available for the districts to postpone and elongate the timeline. Currently, the exceptions to the timelines include... if the parent repeatedly fails or refuses to produce the child or other circumstances outside the district's control, the parent can agree in writing with the district to extend the timeline. And that's in our current OARs. Understaffed evaluation teams and no infrastructure for summer evaluations, I think, is probably the biggest concern for districts, and I don't have an answer for that, because there will be tight timelines, and it will take a lot of thinking about how to staff evaluation teams over the summer and longer breaks. It will probably cost money in terms of contracts for subcontractors to provide these evaluations during the summer. I think eventually that districts will be able to mitigate some of that by really beefing up their child find efforts in the late summer and early fall terms to make sure that we're not looking at evaluations at the end of the school year. But for now, I think it'll probably end up costing some money and requiring some outside-the-box thinking. So just for some comparison and to bring home what this difference in calendar days versus school days looks like, I've got several versions of a school calendar following this slide. In all slides, calendar day calculations are in blue and school day calculations are in green. Written consent, the start of the timeline is always in yellow. Purple shows the first and last day of school, and then pink is the weekends and holidays. So in this first one, given the best case scenario, if a consent is offered 2 days after the first day of school, in other words, the parent signs a consent for evaluation, under the calendar day, under the calendar day timeline, 60 calendar days from the 4th of September is November 3rd. So that's the best case scenario. We're into November. And if you add the IEP 30 days, we're looking at an IEP implemented by December 3rd of a child's year when everybody's already agreed this child needs some specialized support. That's the best case scenario. Under this 60 calendar day timeline, calendar days between consent and an eligibility meeting. Did I do that backward?
Mm-hmm.
November consent, 60 school day timeline is in green. The calendar days between consent and eligibility meeting from an early, oh, I skipped one, that's why. There we go. 60 calendar day redo timeline is in blue here. The consent on September 4th, the eligibility meeting on November 3rd, and the December 3rd. I'm not sure what that means. Okay, let me go to the next one. This is our 60 school day timeline with a consent in November, middle of November. In this case, if a consent is given November 15th, the 60 school day timeline ends March 1st. The 30 day IEP after that is March 31st. So here we've got a child consent in early in mid-November. We don't know the eligibility until March, so pretty much the whole school year is gone.
And so this is basically 270 kids out of 17,000?
No, this is just some
Just scenarios.
Just me counting spaces.
Okay.
here's the worst case scenario, though. In this scenario, an evaluation consent is signed the middle of May. Counting out the 60 school days, counting out the 60 school days would take us to October the 28th of the following school year for this child's eligibility meeting to be held. And adding the up to 30 days for the IEP, we're looking at November 27th for this child to begin to receive special education services. That's a total of 197 calendar days from the time that the child is first the evaluation consent is first given, 197 calendar days. Given the 60 calendar day schedule, a mid-May consent would mean a July 14th eligibility meeting and an IEP on August 13th at the latest, which means before the child begins the next school year, the supports and accommodations required for that child to succeed would be in place rather than waiting and waiting and failing again while they wait.
But there's no staff. Where do they get the staff?
That's the issue that districts are concerned about and would need to consider and work out a system. It used to be we would look to the ESDs, but the ESDs are starting to build capacity in mm-hmm. districts to do evaluations, and summer evaluations weren't part of the thing.
Okay, Robert Wilson, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just asking your opinion on a couple of things. I'm a business guy, so I tend to look at all things through those glasses. I look at the child as the customer here, And the school district is the service provider or the retailer in this particular case.
Okay.
I'm presuming that the goal is good, that an IEP is important to the student, and important to that student's profitability as time goes on. So I guess my question is, if this is a really important thing, that is to get that child taken care of and get that child on an IEP as soon as possible, in your opinion, do school districts look at it with that sense of urgency? Because it is the child who is hanging in the balance here.
Sure.
And so I find it a little interesting that we're talking about money, availability of staff, convenience, and so forth, when in fact you're dealing with a human life that supposedly will benefit greatly by an IEP. Mm-hmm. Am I being too simplistic here? What do you think?
I tend to agree with you that the child is the customer and a really important customer, and that providing services that are needed for the child to succeed in school is an ultimate goal of a school district.
What a thought.
That said, school districts have budgets and budget constraints, and this would require them doing things differently to have a much shorter timeline between a consent and an evaluation meeting to implement an IEP.
If I could follow up. So how about 90 school days? I mean, you know, the question is, would that be really seen as detrimental to the child if you said, well, 60 is too tight, let's push it out to 90?
90 calendar days?
90 school days.
Well, currently we have 60 school days, which is too long.
Right, okay, all right. So that
it would be much too long.
Okay.
This bill is seeking to change it from 60 school days to 60 calendar days.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So would 90 calendar days be too long? I think that's a
it would be going the wrong direction.
It would be going in the
right,
wrong direction,
right. Okay.
But it would be more right, I think, than 60 school days.
Yeah. Thanks.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do these children need evaluation every year? I mean, if they're carried over from grade to grade, this evaluation is done once. Well, I would say once to qualify them, but then I'm sure they're evaluated every year, but to fall into the program.
Thank you. That's an excellent question. So these timelines apply only to the initial evaluation. From when the parent says, yes, I'd like this evaluation, and then the initial eligibility meeting. After that, each child who receives an IEP, or specialized education services, is evaluated every 3 years, unless the school district and the parent agrees that an evaluation is unnecessary. For instance, a child who is deaf is still going to be deaf in 3 years. So, you know, it's possible that an evaluation wouldn't necessarily be needed to show what everybody knows.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions of the panelists? Representative Springer.
And thank you, Madam Chair. A couple thoughts I have as we look at this, and first of all, what I haven't seen reflected in these calendars, which is okay, is schools that have four-day weeks.
Oh,
now,
exactly.
Now, granted, there's probably about half that are full weeks, as it is, with a five-day week. So there would be some change in that. But what you're diagramming for us is the potential, good or bad.
Correct.
Of the time frame. I would be interested, because I got to tell you, for the 200, I forgot the number, the roughly 200 students, even 300, that are not meeting these timelines, it's a really, really big deal.
Okay.
And so I would be interested in looking at the data to see if there's trends. Are they occurring in primarily certain school districts? Are they across the board? Is it all over the state? Do we have some trends that might be more helpful for us to determine a remedy, the obstacles, opposed to just do this? Mm-hmm. And did you initially say 17,000 or 1,700 that are meeting the time? So roughly
17,420 students in 2013 met the timeline.
Okay. So I would be, to be the most helpful, so I'm glad to see there's that many students receiving it within a reasonable amount of time. I know my experience with an IEP with our son, it was very quick. Now, some could argue there were reasons it was very quick, but it was very quick.
Because you have a good school district.
That's right. And I would argue that that is a fact. So as we look at that, I wonder if we would be well served to identify the districts at some point where this is occurring. If this is a wholesale problem, then we have a different issue. But I'm encouraged by the 17,000 that did meet the deadline.
Representative Springer, I appreciate that thought. And when I was working with the fine folks at Oregon Department of Education, and they are amazingly great people, much of those data are suppressed because some of those school districts are very small. And so if the number of kids represented in one of these kinds of numbers in a district is seven or fewer, then they suppress that because that makes that data identifiable to a child. So we would have to work with the Oregon Department of Education to see what they've got in terms of trends. This chart, for instance, has at least a four-year trend where we're looking at slightly better timelines each year, a little bit of a blip in 2012 instead of, so we went from 98.6 to 98.4 and then back to 98.7. But I agree with you that for those 242 kids and their families and their teachers who are in need of supports, that's a long time to wait.
Yeah, thank you. Follow-up. Did I understand when you said it's hard to get the data in school districts that are smaller than seven? Do you mean seven students or seven students identified? Because we don't have very many districts smaller than seven. So that's not going to skew
my
our
mistake.
Data.
Yes, Representative Springer. It's for school districts for whom the overage in timeline, there are fewer than seven kids in that group. So fewer than seven kids exceeded the 60 school day calendar. That data is suppressed. So it could be, let's say, a medium-sized school district, like Central School District, just over the river from us. If six kids exceeded the 60 school day timeline, then those data would be suppressed, even though there are maybe 400 kids on IEPs in that district.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Reardon.
Thank you, Chair. This might be my guilty conscience from back when I was a student, but do we have any information on when the evaluation actually started? So if you have a 60 calendar days, sometimes I know as a student, I didn't really get started until maybe a short time before the deadline. So do we have any data like that? And you may not. I would be surprised if you did.
I don't know that ODE collects that data, and I'm trying to think back to when I ran Child Find for Central School District. And we had to indicate when we exceeded the 60 days, but we did not track when the what that start and end date was. Just did we exceed the 60 days?
Okay. Just one brief one.
We've got quite a few people on the list.
Okay. Is it safe to say we really don't know how long it takes to complete the evaluations? How much?
That's right. So Representative Reardon, if I was to finish five evaluations in 10 school days and the rest in 61 school days, I wouldn't know how short or quickly those five went. I would just know it was less than 60.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Is there any data that will show us how often these are done besides the 3 years? Because I know that you don't have to do it except for the 3 years, but I know oftentimes there are IEPs that are done frequently. And so is there any data that says, in addition to the initial IEP and then once every 3 years, on an average, we're also having to touch these students or needing to touch them, you know,
Right.
Once more each year or every other year, or just so that we have an idea of what maybe the workload is. Is there any data?
Thank you, Representative Hack. Let me just clarify first. The individual education program is revised every year. So every child on an IEP has an IEP meeting every year. But we don't have to reevaluate them in terms of whether they still qualify for special education services, except every 3 years after that first initial. Does
so
that make sense?
Follow up. But the same folks, I think what I'm trying to make clear to is that the same folks that do the initial evaluations for the IEPs have to continue to meet with the ones that are already on the IEPs during the same school years and have the same workloads and...
Right. So, Representative Hack, that's true, that within any school year, an evaluation team will have X number of children who are being looked at the first time in an initial eligibility, and one-third the total number of kids on IEPs will have an evaluation due that year also, roughly a third, so that every 3 years everybody gets reevaluated.
Okay. Thank you.
So, and districts can find that information through their IEP databases.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Shane and Toby Reitz, did you guys also want to speak?
Thank you.
She's arrived.
Okay, thank you. We're going to kind of keep an eye on time because we have another...
I'll go
four or five to speak on this issue.
If I can, just if I may, I don't know, a quick follow-up to the question that was asked. For the reevaluation.
If you could need to identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Toby Reitz. I'm the executive director of the Autism Society of Oregon and the parent of two children on the autism spectrum, both of whom have IEPs. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to make a quick follow-up that reevaluations that occur every 3 years, oftentimes you can do them what's called on the file, so it doesn't require a full evaluation process.
Thank you.
Sorry. With that, Chair Doherty and members of the committee, my name is Toby Reitz. I reside in Northeast Portland, and I'm here in my capacity as the Executive Director of the Autism Society of Oregon and the mother of two children on the autism spectrum who receive special ed services. The Autism Society of Oregon is the state's largest autism group and the only one that operates statewide. We represent everyone affected by autism, including individuals on the spectrum and their families, and we represent everyone across the autism spectrum and throughout the lifespan. Our mission is to empower these individuals to improve the quality of their lives through resources, education, advocacy, and support. Over 5,600 people access ASO as a resource and participate in our activities in all regions of the state. I am here in support of House Bill 2673, which would decrease the time that children have to wait to access special education services and promote better communication between schools and families to provide more information on available special ed services to children. HB 2673 aligns Oregon law with a national standard on timing for an initial evaluation or reevaluation at 60 calendar days rather than 60 school days. Under the current 60 school day provision, a family that requested and provided consent for an initial evaluation of an IEP on the first day of school would not receive the completed evaluation until December 4th. Practically speaking, even if the child is eligible for special ed services, he would not receive those services until after the school year resumes in January. And we're talking about services that the child needs to be successful in school. Completing these evaluations in 60 calendar days would result in services being available to the children who need them in a much more timely manner. We understand that the requirement would increase the burden on schools to complete the IEP evaluations faster. However, it's important to note that the majority of school districts across the country use the standards set in HB 2673. Rather than saying that it can't be done here in Oregon, we would be much more interested in determining what needs to happen to get special ed services to our children who need them in Oregon in a much more timely manner so that they can be more effective. HB 2673 would also require school districts to provide families with an annual summary of special education services provided to students during the previous year. As a parent, this seems like common sense to me. Under this bill, our families are not asking for additional services, but for information on what services are currently available. The IDEA, the federal law creating IEPs, specifically envisions parents as integral members of the IEP team and requires that we be able to meaningfully participate in IEP meetings. Without information on what services are being provided or are able to be provided, we parents are not participating in a meaningful way. I've been a volunteer supporting other parents at IEP meetings, and I would say they run the gamut from parents saying, "My child's at your school 6 hours a day. Why haven't you cured my child?" to, "I didn't know I could ask for anything on behalf of my child." By requiring a summary of the special education services provided in the previous school year, parents can have the information on what to ask for, and schools aren't faced with parents demanding services that simply don't exist. HB 2673 would also increase information to families about available special ed services by disallowing confidential agreements between school districts and families who have successfully sued the school district. These confidentiality agreements are often a standard part of the settlement agreement. Confidentiality and monetary or compensatory awards would still be retained. But by preventing families from sharing information with other parents about the accommodations or services they've received for their child, inequities between similarly situated students are increased. The disparity in access to services only serves to increase the disparity in outcomes for children with special needs. And a child's access to special education services should not depend on his family's financial ability to afford expensive legal services. So we urge the passage of HB 2673. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Shane?
Members of the committee,
we'll
thank
finish
you.
The panel and then.
Shane Jackson, lobbyist for the Autism Society of Oregon, thank you again. I've spoken with each of you individually, as you know, and so I'll keep my comments very, very short. Really, how I look at HB 2673 is certainty. And who enjoys the luxury of certainty? Do the parents enjoy the luxury of certainty in knowing that when they can put their finger on a calendar and know that in 60 days their IEP will begin? Or does the school district administrator put a finger on a calendar and say, "I know by this day I will have all my forces marshaled"? I think the certainty should go towards the parents. And we should be able to point to a calendar and tell our parents on what day it's going to happen. The same thing with services offered. The certainty of knowing what is available and what is not available. All of our parents should enjoy the certainty of knowing that list exists. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Toby, I was wondering, you have two children that are autistic, and did you have them tested before they went into school so you knew there was an issue?
Yes, my Chair Doherty and Representative Barreto, my personal situation is a little bit different in that we moved to Oregon 6 years ago. My children were both already diagnosed and had IEPs back east. So we came in with the IEP in place, and then it was reviewed after about 6 weeks, and a new IEP was made based on Oregon services.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. So it didn't transfer over from the other state then?
Chair Doherty and Representative Barreto, yes, it does transfer from the other state, but then after, I think, in our school district it was about 6 weeks, they redo the IEP because now they've had a chance to kind of work with the child and look at the services that were being provided in the previous state and what services actually translate here in Oregon, because not everything is the same.
Representative Frederick. Do you have a question, Representative Hack?
Yep, thank you, Chair. So you have firsthand experience working with a lot of families, I'm sure. And what are you hearing? Are there frustrations? What's happening that we don't know?
Chair Doherty and Representative Hack, the frustrations are myriad. The main frustration that I hear over and over again is not knowing what services are available to help our children and the timeline in getting those services in place. The idea that when a parent is consenting to an IEP evaluation, everyone's aware there's an issue. I mean, or else there wouldn't be the need for consent. There's some concern there. And then to find out that it's going to be until probably January before anything can seriously be done to help this child. When you have a child who needs help, that's agonizing. It's particularly a young child. So
what are the reasons for that, though? Are they hearing what the reasons are? Sorry, follow-up was...
You know, Chair Doherty and Representative Hack, I don't think parents are unreasonable. We recognize that there is only so much that can be done. As a matter of fact, you know, I think parents tend to be err on the side of being too reasonable and not realize they're not advocating enough. But when you have families who are waiting, you know, worst case scenario, 270 days to get services for their child, sure, that's frustrating. I think we all recognize there's limits. We can't be done tomorrow. But certainly we shouldn't have to waste half the school year without getting services.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? You want Reardon to go before you? Representative Reardon and then Representative Frederick?
No, I'm not going.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I have just a couple of questions, if I may. I, up until a couple of years ago, I was teaching, and I can't imagine any harder working teachers and special ed teachers trying to get teachers to attend their meetings, trying to get the parents, trying to get the administrators, everybody involved. No, just that was a horrendous job. So two quick questions. Does this bill increase the actual volume of work? I'm trying to be not how long it takes, but the actual volume of work in any way.
Chair Doherty and Representative Reardon, I'm not sure. I to me, we're not asking them to do anything more, except for in terms of the timeline. The timeline is compressed if you're looking at 60 calendar days rather than 60 school days. For the other things, to provide an annual list of the special ed services that are being provided, I can see that as some additional work. I can't imagine that is burdensome or unduly burdensome. It's simply a report of what you've provided. It's not asking for additional services.
Yeah. Follow on.
Follow up, and then Mr. Jackson had an answer also.
Oh. Sure.
May I attempt to also chime in on that? Thank you, Chair Doherty. Representative Reardon, as you saw there, most of the extensions over 60 days was a product of school district doing not being able to get everything on all the assets together. We feel that the 60 calendar day timeline is not a overburdening compression of their of the resources they need to marshal to accomplish their goals. Most other states do it within a timeline like this, and we're kind of an outlier in the definition of those rules from the IDEA Act, and we're an outlier amongst our fellow states in that ability. So I think if we just ask people to bring that in to a date certain on a calendar, it's not a overburdensome request.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, anything else? Okay, thank you very much. The next three we have, Todd Nicholson, Danny Johnson, and John, I may bring up four of you, John Petty and Michael Salatori. And make sure you state your name for the record. And a little under time crunch, not much. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak on this important bill. My name is Danny Johnson, and I'm a special education teacher and case manager in the Hillsborough School District. Parents are an integral part of the special education team, and being a parent myself, I can understand why the 60-day timeline addressed in House Bill 2673 is beneficial. However, as a special education teacher, I do have some concerns about the impact it will have on our students, and therefore I'm in opposition. As professionals, we try to meet and respect deadlines, and I know it is my personal goal to complete tasks prior to deadlines, especially when the issue involves communicating with parents, dealing with parents, and providing services to our students. And as you can see in the data that was shown earlier, most times we do meet those deadlines. But my fear with the 60 calendar day deadline proposed in House Bill 2673 is that we will be sacrificing what is best for our students in order to speed up a process. As I'm sure you know, working with special education students is an individual process, and each student's needs vary, and that includes the needs during evaluation process. Sometimes we need to work with outside professionals in a mental health or a medical field in order to gather information. Sometimes that starts with getting the parents those services so that they can gather the information and then share with us the educational repercussions. A more specific example that comes to my mind is a student that I had on my caseload not a year ago. This young lady had such severe anxiety that she was unable to come to school. We had an initial evaluation meeting, and we initiated the process. The team determined that the student would need a variety of evaluations, and because of the specific needs of this student, in order to get valid and reliable results, the student could only be evaluated for short periods of time, and because of her anxiety, we could only meet with her once every couple of days. Because of all these factors, we did run up until that 60 school day deadline, and this is just one example of many where, because of the student need, we had to have that 60 school day timeline. I know that 60 school days seems like a long period of time. However, during that period, we are not just evaluating the student. We are constantly communicating with the parents. And as part of the process, we are conducting interventions to help determine that educational impact of the student's disability. To us, the 60 school day timeline is not just in time to evaluate, but to determine the academic functioning and the types of intervention that would be most beneficial for our students. To do that, we need to build rapport with the student. We need to observe the student in an educational setting, as well as sometimes a social setting. And of course, we need to conduct the assessments, some of which cannot be done in one fell swoop. And if we want to get accurate, valid, reliable, and useful results, some of these things cannot be done with fidelity if the timeline falls, say, during a summer break. Another concern I have, which I'm sure comes to the mind of all administrators, is that of a budgetary concern. To make employees available during a non-contract break puts a strain on an already stretched budget. With this bill, if an evaluation and then an eligibility, which then of course leads to an IEP, happens to fall during summer break, the cost of having the appropriate members of the team in attendance is tremendous. At the secondary level, this would mean, at a minimum, the school psychologist or other specialists that conducted the evaluations, the special education teacher who will provide services, the special education case manager, at a minimum one general education teacher, but with what is best for the students, many more, any specialists needed, such as speech language pathologist, occupational therapist, physical therapist, oftentimes ESL staff for dual identified students, and at the secondary level, a transition teacher or specialist. To have each of these team members available during non-contract time would take away monies from an already tight budget, and that could go directly to impacting the student's instruction. As I'm sure you know, the IEP is not a magic bullet. The IEP document serves as a communication tool. It is a document that is built by a team that describes and records what is the best for the students instructionally. In order for this document to be useful, it has to be accurate. And for it to be accurate, we must conduct evaluations and assessments in a way that will produce the best results. And sometimes this takes a while. To diminish the amount of time that we are allowed to do this in would only impact the student. If we rush through an evaluation just to get an IEP in place, we are doing the student a disservice by providing services based on rushed, possibly invalid results. In conclusion, the things that I hope you will consider with this bill as case managers and special education teachers, we are using the 60 school days currently in place for much more than evaluating a student. And because we are invested in doing what's best for our students, we feel that rushing through assessments do not provide us with valid and usable information. And lastly, our budget is already stretched so thin and will only be pulled further with the implementation of a shorter timeline.
Okay, thank you. Next, and with a lot of you, we have your testimony. So if you could summarize, please.
Very good. Thank you, Chair. For the record, my name is Dr. John Petey. I'm the Student Services Director for Hillsborough School District. I'm here to testify in opposition to House Bill 2673 due to the change in assessment from 60 school days to 60 calendar days. As you've heard today, assessment for special education services by law provides many positive purposes. It gives a greater depth to the student knows, identifies if a student has an eligibility through disability, and can help identify the services a child may need to equitably obtain an education to be successful based on their needs.
The process requires a tremendous amount of personnel resources in order to make the assessment system work properly. Assessment by a psychologist, special education teacher, specialists, speech pathologists, general education teachers, oftentimes many of them, parents and school staff work together to help identify a particular child's needs. Assessment often takes an extended amount of school days or weeks due to the amount of personnel needed. But that's not all. The student also plays a large role in this process. Assessment is not a factory model where a specialist can swoop in and assess at any given time or extended period of time. In fact, often the specialists involved with the assessment have to work with school staff, families, and student schedules and students' needs. Many of my teachers have caseloads well over 30 students, and they often schedule assessments based on what the students can handle at any given time or on a particular day. Some days they would assess for an hour or more, and some days assess in small chunks of time depending on the student. On other days they would stop the assessment as the student was not prepared to be assessed on that day. Assessment takes time, it takes trust, and it takes knowledge of the student. And when there are multiple assessments happening at the same time, this process of scheduling and assessing can become very complicated. When assessment is rushed, it gives the impression or viewpoint that special education is the magic bullet to fix a student. A rush system tells schools that interventions are not as important to help students. Interventions tried prior to the special education referral process allow us to separate between difference and disability. When intervention is not tried properly and assessment is rushed, there is a great opportunity for special education to become a place rather than thoughtful use of resources for students to obtain an equitable education. Ultimately, assessment may lead to the possibility of eligibility for special education services, the one of 9 eligibilities in Oregon. But it also creates a label that student wears for their entire school life, if not beyond. This process needs to be done carefully, thoughtfully, and not rushed. Not all labels are bad, but when labels are applied or not applied to rush processes, then our system has failed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Chairman Doherty and members of the Education Committee. For the record, my name is Todd Nicholson, and I'm a school psychologist in the Beaverton School District. I have been a school psychologist for 12 years, and I've worked directly with students, parents, as well as multidisciplinary evaluation teams. My professional life has been dedicated to improving educational and life outcomes for every child, especially those with our most vulnerable and challenged learners. The proposed House Bill 2673, specifically Section 4.5, which proposes changing the initial and reevaluation timelines from 60 school days to 60 calendar days, would have a tremendous negative effect on the quality of the evaluation, as well as the quality and appropriateness of the interventions for students eligible for special education. Psychoeducational evaluations are much different from psychological evaluations that are readily obtained in the community. Psychoeducational evaluations are tailored specifically to the educational concerns of the child referred. For example, in addition to evaluating a struggling student's cognitive processes, say in a learning disability, the evaluation must also seek to systematically analyze and evaluate the student's interaction with his or her educational environment. This takes time. The better, the more comprehensive the evaluation, the better and the more informed the educational interventions. In other words, the better the IEP. Taking shortcuts in this area leads to more educational failure, as a student would likely be given imprecise interventions and experience even more failure. An additional concern is labeling students as having a disability when really they don't, and additional time is necessary to help sort this out. Without a doubt, you have received comments from other educators and administrators which speak to the considerable burden that this will place on an already stretched educational system. I agree with these concerns, and I fear that overall students will receive less instructional time. The professionals who conduct the evaluations are also those who provide specially designed instructions to large number of students on large caseloads. To meet a 60-day timeline for every single referred student would place special educators in the precarious position of choosing how they are going to be out of compliance, either by not providing the services in the IEP or conducting evaluations. Either way, they're out of compliance, and this would be a problem.
I was recently involved in a complex evaluation for a student who was found eligible for special education services under the category of autism spectrum disorder. The evaluation necessitated 9 specialists coordinating over 60 hours of evaluation. Of this 60 hours of evaluation, approximately 74% of that time consisted of direct interaction or direct observation with the student who was referred. Additionally, remaining time is needed for the evaluators to work together to synthesize and to provide the most complete picture of the student. If the team was required to adhere to a 60 calendar day timeline, the team would have actually had less than 43 school days to complete the evaluation when you account for weekends, holidays, absences, and training. The student would experience test fatigue, which not only compromises the integrity of the evaluation because it's done in such a condensed format, in fact, it would further harm the student's perception of herself. A wise educator once remarked, "If the necessary groundwork for any intervention has not been laid, the likelihood that that intervention will be successful is greatly reduced." Comprehensive and thoughtful evaluation lays that groundwork, and I urge you to consider these and other unintended consequences of this bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Saltzori.
Chair Doherty.
As I say, we have your written testimony if you want to summarize what you have. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Chair Doherty, members of the House Education Committee. My name is Michael Salator. I'm the Executive Director of Supported Education in the Molalla River School District. While I do understand the desire for special ed evaluations to happen in a more timely fashion, I don't believe 2673 is the answer. I oppose 2673 for the following reasons, and I'll just summarize. I'm really speaking from the rural communities. We in the state are challenged by shortages of folks who are qualified examiners to conduct these evaluations. One example is I don't have a physical therapist to serve my kids in Molalla River. I've been trying every single contact agency. Most of them are on the East Coast. They don't understand where Oregon is on the map, much less Molalla River. And trying to find a PT to come and do one doggone evaluation that we signed in the fall to have them, you know, get that figured out. And fortunately, I have some contacts over in Washington, and they were able to send someone down to connect me to MESD. And it was about through those personal connections that I was able to find a half-a-day person to come and do it. We're 45 minutes out of Salem, 45 minutes out of Portland, and we still experience it. We're not a small district. We're about a medium size, 2,300 and change. But we really are challenged by the lack of folks, and this timeline would really hamper our efforts. And as these folks have pointed out, good evaluation takes time. Personally, my son was evaluated for special ed when he was in elementary school, and you know what? He was misidentified. Because I believe the team went too darn quick. They said, boom, boom. We were using the discrepancy system, and it did my son a disservice because they went too fast. And I really want you all to hear that voice as well. A couple of other things. I am coming from Washington. And the presentation up there around, you know, missed timelines and all that, and comparing to other states, the one piece that I'm seeing that's missing is that in Washington State, a medical statement is not required for autism spectrum disorder or emotional disturbance. So it's not just an apples-to-apples comparison looking at the timelines. Frankly, I believe the answer is really in clear leadership and guidance around the referral process. And bigger systems change. When systems move toward multi-tier systems of support, we use universal screeners and we catch kids earlier. Districts are moving in this direction, and we're getting there. We're not there yet. And I understand parents' desire to, you know, I work with Ms. Rates collectively as a partner to get this job done for our kids. But I don't know that shrinking the timeline is the answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any quick questions? We have another bill we have to get through. Quickly?
One quick thing, and then I will talk maybe offline. My concern about three different things come to mind. One is the concern about compliance, the constant concern about compliance. But I also think that it needs to be connected with parent trust. And one of the biggest issues, you brought it up, and you're the only one of the panel to actually bring up the issue in terms of trust. Parent trust, there's a sense that the districts are primarily concerned about compliance and not the trust and the concern about what happens with the kids. If you're waiting 3 months to get something, 3 months is a long time to be waiting for whatever results might come in and whatever tests might be taken. And for those parents, that's a real problem. So your issue that I see is primarily capacity, and I think we need to try to find some way to really deal with that. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Quickly, Mr. Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, it seems to me what I heard, though, was that it takes a while to really evaluate these kids, and they're all different, and they're all over the map. And so working with these kids every day is not like you're neglecting these children. What you're doing is working with them to try and evaluate them the best you can, and that takes time.
Yes.
Is that?
Yes.
That's fair.
Anything else? Quickly, Representative
Real quickly. When you have a list of students that you have to work through, you know, like say you have 70, how do you prioritize which children are going to be tested first?
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
I think that what we do is obviously we have to take a look at timelines, and someone that has a consent signed before someone else obviously would be in the lineup quicker. However, we do have to evaluate what type of evaluation we're doing and how long that evaluation is going to take, and then what type of student we're working with. You know, certain evaluations do take a really quick turnaround. You can, you know, do an academic achievement test and be done with it and have your data. Others require a lot more. And so I think that when we try to be compliant, but then also serve the student the best, we just have to evaluate or prioritize based on, you know, what timeline we have and then what we need to get done for the student.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Chair Doherty,
if I may
just respond very quickly. Yeah. You bring up a really good point, Representative McLean. How do we prioritize? Because if I'm a parent and I say, oh, gosh, okay, we got this thing in the system, I'm checking my clock, I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, and I get that. I get that we could do a better job with communicating and letting folks know. But from our side of the aisle here, what happens is we'll have a student move in. All of a sudden, oh my gosh, they're massive mental health crisis. We've got to scramble and work with them because they're throwing chairs in a classroom, or they've got just massive crisis-driven stuff. And so there's those kinds of things that the other parents that are kind of waiting don't necessarily hear about. And I get that tension, but we are doing a lot of crisis management in special education.
Okay. Okay. And I appreciate that. I've been a school teacher in Hillsboro for 42 years, and there was sometimes, you know, school, you'd get a teacher referral, too,
yeah.
Because you're having those kinds of crises, and my understanding was that those went to the top of the list. So,
okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for coming down
thank
and
you.
Testifying. Okay, that's all that we had signed up for House Bill 2673. I'm going to close the public hearing and open up a public hearing on 2757.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2657 directs the State Board of Education not to consider days pupils absent when determining aggregate days membership for purposes of distributions from the state school fund. It provides that aggregate days membership should be calculated based upon the number of hours of instruction people received in the previous year. It takes effect July 1st, 2016. The committee has been asked to consider the -2 amendments, which removes provisions in the introduced bill relating to partial attendance. It allows the inclusion of excused absences in determination of aggregate days membership, and it allows the State Board of Education to consider partial day attendance rather than hours-based attendance. The measure has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair Doherty, Committee. For the record, my name is Representative Betty Kopp from House District 22. What I would like to share with you is, first of all, the bill referred to by your committee staff, the first part of the bill, and this is why I was so confused the last time we were here. The -2s are a complete gut and stuff. There is nothing in the first bill that is part of what I'm asking you to consider. You should have, and what we are handing out is a summary of House Bill 2657-2. I really am looking forward to talking with you a little bit more about this legislation and really the why. I've had emails about this legislation. I've had quite a few different calls, and I've had newspapers contact me, and there has been only one newspaper that found this bill as not in the best interest of our students. I've had a couple of our colleagues talk to me and saying that potentially the small districts might be penalized because of this. So what I decided to do, and I don't know what all of you think before the day before you testify about an important bill for you, but I fall asleep thinking about these things. And the one comment that kept going through my mind is, well, how small districts aren't going to be able to handle this. They won't have enough personnel. And so I wanted to share my experience as a high school administrator for 4 years that I did attendance. But before I share what I did with attendance, I want to tell you a little bit about my job description. I was the curriculum director. I was the supervisor for new administrators. I did bus duty a minimum of an hour every day. I did lunch and breakfast duty a minimum of an hour every day. I did classroom observations. Here's an example about after school events. I attended every one of the wrestling matches because I was the only female administrator in the building, and they needed somebody to weigh in the female wrestler. The list goes on. I was the administrator that the principal said, we're going to have Saturday school, Betty, about this attendance. So I got to use half my Saturday, you know, asking kids to come to school that didn't come to school on a regular day. So those are a few things that I did as an administrator. And what I want to share with you was we had a serious problem in our high school. Up to 33% to 38% of our students were absent every day. And what that did was cause a tremendous amount of reteaching by the teachers, students that would get left, quote unquote, left behind because they were absent so often they couldn't catch up. This was the high school at that time did not quite have, I think it was about 800 to 900 students. And there were two administrators that dealt with this issue. And so when people say, well, I think it's going to impact small schools, I don't know what their definition is. But I could tell you as an administrator of a school of middle schoolers of 550, I knew most of the kids' names. I knew who they were. And I certainly knew the 400-plus students that I had responsibility for my half of the alphabet for discipline and attendance. But what I want to share with you is kind of some really hard realities when you really dig into and look at student attendance. And I'm not going to go on forever because I know your last presentations took a little bit of time. But and some of this is going to be hard to hear. But these are the students that I got to know. And what I heard from students would come to me and they'd tell me that they weren't there because they had thought about attempting suicide that day. So we could do it. Therefore, we did an immediate intervention with that student. I had students that I would go to their best friend and say, well, where's Susie today? Well, Ms. Comp, she went and had an abortion. A lot of the students that were absent on a regular basis, they had addictions. Many of them used inhalants, marijuana, crack, meth. These are the students that still are in my heart, because one of those students last summer at age 36, who had an addiction of, she would inhale anything, died at the age of 36. The other thing that you see in this role is when students come in, they'll show you the bruises on their body. We'll take the pictures, we'll call the police, and we will get them help. Worst case scenario, student is absent 2 days. We couldn't find him. He literally killed his girlfriend and buried her in a shallow grave one city away. We would not have known any of these things if we didn't look at attendance very seriously. And this bill is designed to have schools really take a look at their students. I just cannot tell you how many of these students, I still see them, I'm in contact with them. The other thing that happens, Representative Springer will have a little bit of understanding of this. In the middle of the night, the police officer would come knocking at my door, and they would find a student that was very disorientated, had their meds mixed up, and they say, "Do you know Billy?" And I said, "Yes." "Well, can you vouch for him?" And I said, "That's absolutely, you know, who he is and where he lives." And I couldn't have done that if I didn't do attendance the way I did it. And this was a district decision. We went way beyond what the state required. But in my heart, and that's why I'm here today, this is why schools need to do this. If you have 10 students, as some of our schools do in the center of Eastern Oregon and Ashwood, Oregon, or if you're in Lapine, I had, in fact, Lapine, a superintendent, emailed me and said, "Go for it. We need to do these things for our students. How much do our students mean to us?" And if a school district, I'm sorry, I have to tell you one other story.
Okay, and I'm going to have to, I hate to cut you off, but
you do.
We have 5 other people that we need to speak.
But what I want, I think you can understand my passion and why. We had a mother come to us at the middle school level. She had a feeling her daughter was going to take off with her 26-year-old boyfriend. She came to school within a half an hour after school started. The young lady was not in the school. We could not find her. And I shouldn't have told the story. We never did find her. She never ever came back to school, and her mother never ever heard from her again. We had policies in place again where we checked up on our students within an hour of when the first bell rang. And if we don't do these types of things, what I'm asking you is, how much do our students mean to us? Is it important enough to check to see where they're at, what they're doing? And I would love to sit down and discuss with any of you what it's like to be in some of these situations. And my stories go on and on and on, because there were stories at least once a day, if not several times a day, that you'd find out information. Oh, I have another one, but I won't say it, Representative.
Yeah. Well, and as I say, because the one question I have, and anyone that's been a teacher has gone through this kind of thing, but what I can't understand is I don't understand how this program will help the children that you're talking about. I mean, I taught in an area, we had attendance counselors, we had all of this kind of thing, and the same sort of funding that we have now. So what I can't understand is, is it the idea that if districts are kind of threatened that they're not going to get money if they don't deal with attendance? Is that what kind of a reverse thing? I just don't understand.
Thank you for the question, Chair Doherty. No, I want to say that how our children are valuable, and if this, yes and no, it should not be a threat. Every school should be doing this regardless. But if it takes what we're doing isn't working.
Well, in some districts it is.
Absolutely. So, yeah. Absolutely it is. And yet when we continually get the reports that we're the fourth from the bottom on this and fourth from the bottom on that, seriously, folks, what's wrong with the picture? I think we as legislators have an absolute responsibility to say, well, what if we did it a different way? Would we get a different result?
Okay. Any other questions? Quickly, Representative Peluso.
Representative Comp, can you remind me what district you were in?
House District 22, and that's Woodburn, Jervison, and North Salem.
The school district, I mean.
Woodburn.
Woodburn. Well, I just got to say they were lucky to have you and appreciate all that service. That's incredible.
Absolutely incredible. Any other question? Representative Rudin.
Representative Comp, thank you very much for being here. Could you tell me the graduation rate in Woodburn School District?
The graduation rate last year was, I believe it was 93%.
Wow. Anything to do with kids being there?
I think it has a lot to do with the initiatives that we started 20 years ago, absolutely. This is not something that happens in a day. And yes, those are students that aren't supposed to be being successful and that sort of thing. Okay. Yes, and the amount of our students that are now in college is very, very heartwarming.
It's a great school district, very good school district.
Well, it took us a while to make that change, oh, yeah. Representative.
Oh, yeah. Okay, any other questions?
I was curious what would be.
Thank you, Representative Comp. Appreciate your passion on this issue very much. Okay, the next two, and I'm going to give you guys about 5 minutes. And this is addition, because you spoke before last time we had this, is Iris Maria Chavez and Kylie Gruno. And we have your written testimony, so I am going to make it short.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Iris Maria Chavez. I'm the Government Affairs Director with Stanford Children, Oregon. I'll be very brief because you do have my testimony on your system. I just want to say that I am here to speak in support of House Bill 2657. We as a state, as Representative Comp have pointed out, have a fairly tragic chronic absenteeism and general absenteeism problem here. It starts as low as the kindergarten classes where we have 1 in 4 students who are chronically absent. And we know that that does have a huge impact on their attendance later in their academic careers as well as their academic performance. I do want to point out that one of the things that Representative Comp has spoken about that we feel strongly about is creating a system-wide value on attendance. And if that's something that we as a state value is attendance and student learning, then we need to make sure that all aspects of our education system have that embedded in it. And this is one way of doing that. A number of states have attendance-based measures in place for their school funding formulas. All of those states, I would like to point out, have better absenteeism have better attendance, rather, than Oregon does. These are states that have had them for either 30-plus years or short periods of time, but they have institutionalized the practices of looking for their students, keeping them engaged, and keeping them in the classroom. We'd like to see Oregon take a similar kind of focus in its education system. What I would also like to point out is that the amendments do provide the opportunity for a phased-in implementation, which will allow districts and schools to really work to identify the challenges that students are facing and strategies and plans to work on those. We as an organization are committed to the system-wide focus on attendance and reducing absenteeism. We understand that this is only one part of a larger solution, and we look forward to working with you on all of the other aspects of that.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Kylie Gernow, and I'm the Public Policy Director for the Chalkboard Project, and I will also be brief. You just received my written testimony. Transitioning to an attendance-based funding formula like that proposed in House Bill 2657 was one of Chalkboard's original recommendations in our K-12 action plan released in 2006, and as we stated then and continue to know now, kids can't learn if they aren't in school, and unfortunately too many of our kids aren't in school, and in my written testimony, you'll see a number of pieces of research and reports that highlight that problem in Oregon. It's clear that our system isn't addressing the issue. We need to take it more seriously, and it's something that our current system does not do. We believe that creating a system in which supporting and valuing attendance is at the very heart of the funding formula will help address that. And as Ira said, in other states where that is the case, they do a much better job than Oregon. So because of that, Chalkboard is encouraged to see this concept moving forward in House Bill 2657. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of this panel?
Just a statement at some point. If you want me to...
Quickly?
Yes, quickly. First of all, I at this point, I can't find a way to support the bill. I don't think it actually does anything towards the problems of getting kids into school. I think that it is basically trying to use resources as a hammer, and I find that to be a real problem because we're already under-resourced as it is. And the idea of solve this problem or else is just bad psychology and bad policy, in my view, especially in an environment of scarcity. If it does send a message, I don't understand. I don't know of a single professional in the schools who doesn't think that absent kids are a problem. Everyone that I've talked with when I was teaching, that was clearly the case. So it's either treating adults like fractious children, or it's just saying that the message is that it really doesn't matter how well you do because you're just not doing enough. I think we have a situation where we can't continue to believe that we can't solve this problem without additional resources, without resources generally. And that's a real problem for me because punitive practices and philosophies, that does not work. We've actually seen business decide to no longer use this kind of approach of punitive punishment regimes in business. This bill doesn't actually move any money. A little bit is taken away from the low-income districts that would, summarize here. If we want to reduce absenteeism, we should follow up with the kids to find out what they need to be in school.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions or comments from this panel?
I just have one question. I'd really be interested in whatever data you were talking about as far as other states and what they were able to do, and I would appreciate it if you could get it to our administrator and he could share it with us.
Sure. We'd be more than happy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, anything else? Okay, thank you very much. The last two we have, Morgan Allen and Lori Wimmer. Give you five.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. Morgan Allen from the Oregon School Boards Association. I think it is important we acknowledge that we do have a serious attendance problem in Oregon, particularly for students in poverty and our students of color. And I think on the face this sounds reasonable. Why would we give schools money for days kids aren't at school? But I think the committee recognized and should recognize this is a foundational shift in how we fund schools. I think the argument is that it will somehow incentivize districts to do a better job. But if you look at the research, we really believe one of the unintended consequences is you're going to move money from poorer districts to wealthier districts. And the gentleman from Echo Northwest, his data showed that exactly. And I think if you look at the national research, there's an organization called Attendance Works, which is a nationally recognized organization funded by the Kellogg and Annie E. Casey Foundations, and they have a fantastic report, all kinds of steps and recommendations and best practices, and not one of them is use the funding as a hammer. So we certainly think that this is a problem in Oregon. We certainly think it's something we should do, but we're not sure the research bears out that this is the right approach. And just to kind of give a couple examples, I think we don't even have the data to know what this does. I looked at the presentation from the gentleman from Echo Northwest a little closer. The state doesn't track unexcused versus excused absences, and I think if you did, you'd find that that would further exacerbate the problem between rich and poor districts, just to be very blunt about it. And that presentation, I think, really tried to minimize potentially the amount of money that might move around. Talked a lot about 1% here and there. Well, 1% of the state school funds $75 million, and that's a lot of money to be moving from districts that probably need it more to districts that probably need it less. So that's our concern. Happy to work on this issue. We think it's important. We think it's a big problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing 42,000 members of the Oregon Education Association. And we echo a lot of what you've heard today. You have my written testimony. It is pertinent to the Dash 2 amendments as well. So I will very quickly give you the highlights of that. We first of all want to say that we appreciate the sponsor's concern about chronic absenteeism and truancy. And we share that concern. And we know that if students aren't there, they aren't learning. And so we would like to thank Representative Comp for her care and for her passion on this issue. But we are also concerned about the unintended consequences of this particular approach to solving the problem, because we don't think it does. And that's perhaps why just 5 states out of 50 have this kind of a program. We want to look at the underlying causes of truancy and absenteeism, because that's how you derive a successful solution. And I've outlined some of the problems that are the underlying causes in my written testimony. I urge you to read them. And those factors have only been exacerbated by our 15 years of underfunding our schools, which have taken away enrichments and all kinds of other programs that keep marginal students in school. This bill's approach ignores those underlying causes and instead punishes districts, as you've heard, and the students in them. So we believe that this impact will disproportionately harm the kids that need it most in the places where the absenteeism is the highest. We believe, though, that if you were to take a look at those underlying causes in Oregon, as Mr. Allen just suggested, through maybe a task force, and turn this bill into a task force that looks at the data underlying the problem as it relates to our Oregon school students, that maybe we would get more information that would help us derive a solution that is more on point and targeted. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions from panelists?
I should probably just be quiet, but I just, if not this approach, what approach? How long have we known that attendance is a big issue? I've been a school teacher, I've been a board member, and if the kids aren't there, you can't teach them. And I'm really concerned about taking another couple of years to do a task force and just study the issue. We surely know what the problems are. You know, I close my comment with, attended a couple of schools where the emphasis was put on attendance using existing resources, and the school's been a model school for about 3 years running. And all they did was they had the principal and one other person get together every morning. They looked at the attendance, found out who was absent. They would call them after a short time. And they just got on it. And I'm sorry if it takes a hammer to get people to do that and to pay attention, but that is what our, if that's our value, and people pay attention to the money, if that's what it takes, then maybe that's what we need to do, because we aren't doing a very good job right now. So,
Madam Chair.
Well, when I taught, people in first period prep, we used to go to the kids' houses. And trust me, high school teacher goes to your house once, you will never be late for school again.
Madam Chair, if I might just respond to the representative for
quickly,
just a
please.
I agree that we need to figure this out, and we need to figure it out sooner rather than later. But I think we have a couple hints, and I don't think it's the school's fault in most cases. I'm personally the guardian of some children whose family was raised in poverty, and the stories they've told me about themselves and others about being too embarrassed to go to school because they didn't have the right clothes, and about having to take care of children who are younger in the family because they couldn't afford babysitters and that kind of thing. There's a lot more there than we may know. But if we don't have the right solutions, I mean, you talk about a hammer, but children are not nails.
Yeah. Representative Jack.
Thank you, Chair. I understand the frustration we all have that with getting kids to school, but my concern would be somewhat of what you're saying, so I appreciate what you just said, in that, you know, a lot of these kids end up with 9 out of 10 risk factors before they ever get out of bed. And so mom's concerned about keeping the lights on and food in the fridge, and for us to come to her then, my concern would be that we're going to tell her now that you have one more thing to worry about, that your child's education may be, the funding for that may be hurt because you can't get them to school or there's an issue. I think that we're just compounding the problem by saying now we're going to tie the dollars to whether or not you can get them there. And I think it's better if we look at counselors in our schools, more truancy officers, how are we connecting with these kids. Everything that Representative Comp had to say was about connections with kids. It wasn't about taking dollars out of schools.
I'm going to get off my soapbox. So okay. I am not supporting this bill.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. That's all we have signed up for this House bill. So I close the public hearing on House Bill 2657. I'm going to open up a work session on 2186.
Chair Doherty, I move HB 2186 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Frederick moves House Bill 2186 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do you need to say what it is first again before?
Thank
Fresh
you.
Our old memories.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2186 provides that core teaching standards apply to public charter schools. It takes effect July 1st, 2016.
Okay.
It has a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there discussion on this issue? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will be supporting this bill. How can we argue with standards? Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't want to, frankly. I do want it to be clear and on record that we do have two different paradigms set up here, two different organizational charts, two mm-hmm. different ideas in educating students or methods, and we're also not funding one at the same mm-hmm. level. We're funding others, so let's be clear on that, and we can argue that all day long, but I just want a couple things on record. The other thing is, and it was talked about in testimony here, about the funds available, like for class project and stuff in the past. But let's be clear, a charter school's involvement with that is also dependent on their school district.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I can give an example of a school district that pulled out. If the charter school, one of the charter schools in that district had been a part, that charter school would not have had the option under current law to continue that process with the sponsoring district. So let's just be acknowledge that there are a couple differences there. The bottom line is students deserve the best, and I think charter schools are just one of the ways that they can achieve that, and I support the standards for sure.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion?
Madam Chair, just one thing briefly for those who are watching or listening today. This has nothing to do with Common Core.
No, this has nothing to do with Common Core.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson,
keeping
for that clarification. Okay, any other discussion? Okay, seeing none, could you please call the roll, please?
Representative Brito.
Aye.
Representative Patton.
Aye.
Representative McClellan.
Aye.
Representative Puzo.
Aye.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer.
Aye.
Chair Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. I'm going to ask Representative Johnson to carry this on the floor. The last thing we have, so I'm going to close the work session on 2186 and open up a work session on House Bill 3030.
3010. Chair Doherty? Oh, you need to read it.
Sure. House Bill 3010 appropriates monies from the general fund to the Department of Education for the purpose of awarding grants under the CTE Revitalization Grant Program, declares emergency effective July 1, 2015. The committee has not yet heard this bill, but it has been asked to refer it to House Higher Ed.
Yep. And so?
Chair Doherty, I move House Bill 3010 without recommendation to the Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development.
Okay. So Representative Frederick moves House Bill 3010 without recommendation. The Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. Is there discussion? This just kind of got misassigned to us. So.
Doesn't this have to do both with community colleges and its connection with our high school
No, this
system?
Is just CTE funding.
Just the
straight
funding.
Straight
yeah. funding.
Okay. And Representative Reardon's on that committee and is our kind of our liaison. So, okay. Okay, seeing no further discussion, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Pack?
Yes.
Representative McClain?
Yes.
Representative Paluzzo?
Yes.
Representative Reardon?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Brito?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick?
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer?
Yes.
Chair Doherty?
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. And with that, our committee is finished. Okay, with that, the motion passes. And with